Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne here. For National Poetry Month, we're partnering with the new poetry website, asphodel.info, to bring you a new series, The News from Poems. Each week, a major American poet writes a brand new, original work in response to current events. So this week's poet joins us from Houston. His name is Fadi Judah. And in addition to being a poet, he's also a practicing physician. He spent years working as an ER doctor. He's also done stints with Doctors Without Borders. Fadi is the son of Palestinian refugees, and he's also published several award-winning translations of Palestinian poetry. So let's hear his new poem.
Brush with Symbols. America, I'm downloading your heart, your giga, and my CPU is slow. I will have your Corazon when I'm in the dirt. If citizen is gold and revolution silicon, will you take off your clothes and FaceTime me? We're not supposed to. Suppose we are. To end here, we do. And every we is schizo, and I, for every poem a length, and for each span a loyalty oath. America, my motherboard has been acting up since spanking new, my mothership all roots, and we're one boot after reboot. Your windows are apples from a tree. Did I take out the trash? Do I have a curb where I live, a recycling bin, my Monday morning coffee in a black hole, my cigarettes for the homeless on red lights, my lighter handy, their illness, my transplant? America, if I'm a cloud, let's back up and drive the country to the registry, the libraries, river and sea. To which whale will I lose my files? The gray, the blue, extinction, a synecdoche. America, you're smaller than English, greater than predestination, and I, in wanting wisdom, looked ahead at looking back, at Eurydice. Won't you use apoptosis in a poem? I praise thee.
Wow. I love it that your poem made me look up a word, apoptosis. Turns out it's a medical scientific term.
Sure, yeah.
Meaning?
Programmed cell death and the process around that. I bring it up because it's fascinating that we live in a time where that's our conversation around mortality is at the cellular level. Advances in gene therapy and stem cell research and so forth. And at the same time, you know, even as a physician, I think we live in a culture where the conversation about dying and illness is terribly lacking. And I think it reflects in our general culture.
What about that first line, America, I'm downloading your heart, your giga, and my CPU is slow. I love that. And then these images, America, my motherboard, which calls to mind waterboard, boot after reboot. A computer term, but makes one think of boots against heads and bodies. And it's complex what you're doing, I think.
yes, I think that you're absolutely right about double references and also having an echo to the historical problems that we've had as a powerful nation or a powerful collective, you know, by mentioning words such as mothership and roots, and even the windows and the apples from a tree somehow are as contemporary and advanced as they are biblical and mythological.
Yeah, I love that. Your windows are apples from a tree. So there you've got both major computer companies and a biblical reference all in one line.
Yeah, well,
I'm
glad.
Yeah. What were you thinking about when you wrote this? What was going on in your life that prompted it?
Two things. I bought a new computer, a desktop, And it started giving me problems. I'm not the most tech-savvy person, and I got really pissed off. And that's one thing. The other thing was I was reading some essays and writings by James Baldwin in anticipation of going to see the movie I Am Not Your Negro. Mm-hmm. So that really is part of what drove this. And obviously, you know, as an Arab American, I... the rest of it is something I've lived with since my younger days, and I suspect, sadly, I will continue to live with for years to come.
I was wondering about your background. You're the son of Palestinian refugees. I think your family fled following the creation of the State of Israel.
Correct. My father was about 14 or so when that happened. My mother was born in that year. And yes, and that formed their, obviously, the rest of their lives. My father, who was a history professor, we went to Benghazi, Libya, where he taught for a little bit. And then he got another job in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where he taught also there at the university. And by the time I finished high school and knew or that I wanted to pursue medicine, it was, you know, more logical for me to return to the U.S. as a as an American born and pursue that career here.
Mm. How did you come to be a poet?
You know, I'd argue that the part of the brain that we all have that connects us to poetry was a little too enhanced in mine and never left me.
Are you saying it's a kind of genetic defect?
No, just an enhancement in yes. some people. I'm not sure, you know, I'm sure it is more enhanced in other better writers than I am. But I tend to think of poetry as universal, a universal language of the brain across human societies. But, you know, in the real world, it's not what you think of wanting to become, you know, an author or a poet. It seemed convenient for the son of Palestinian refugees to think of the success and service of the world of medicine. Hmm.
Well, I was thinking you talked about poetry as a universal language, and yet there are cultures in which it's more venerated than others. And there's a long tradition in Arabic cultures of reciting poetry out loud. I've read that you grew up like that, even playing games with poetry.
Yes. You know, I am not a fan of this kind of stereotyping of cultures based on their relationship of poetry or not, because often I think it serves purposes beyond actually the admiration of a particular people's relationship to an expression of language.
Such as what?
Such as sort of what we would call Orientalist expressions or stereotypical expressions of excessive emotionality, reduced relationship to synthetic production of language, say as in prose and novels and research and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, I know for a fact that these undertones exist. But going back to the game you referred to is this particular game of memory where the letter that ends the rhyme in a classical poem would be the letter that you begin the next line with. So if the rhyme word ends with the letter D, your task in the game is to begin a verse with a word that begins with the letter D. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a cyclical fun game of memory and, you know, how much you've memorized and so forth.
You also work as a translator of Arabic poetry. You translated the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish and also Ghassan Zaktan.
Correct, yes. Yeah.
Do those poems in Arabic, of course they sound different, but is there a different rhythm of the language and does the singing part of the poems work differently?
Absolutely. However, when I approach the translation, I place myself in almost a delusional state that I am able to transform the breath, the same length of the breath of the Arabic line into English.
What do you mean?
It never works out that way. Well, it's sort of if I read the line to myself in Arabic, something like إِذَا كُنْتِ آخِرَ مَا قَالَهُ اللَّهُ لِي, if I write down in English, if you are the last thing that God told me, to my ear, they would both have the same rhythm and the same music. But it's because I'm the one reading to myself. And I think the beauty of translation is the openness to what one cannot measure, to that sort of immeasurable feeling, spirit, if you will, that I think is the secret joy of translation, of crossing supposed boundaries and allowing or celebrating a space in the human mind where approximation takes place, if willingness is there.
Mm. You make translation sound in some ways like the beating heart of poetry, because isn't that partly what poetry does, is get right to the perceptions, the feelings, the apprehensions that we cannot quite put into words?
I think it's a lovely way of putting it. And I would say that speech in general is a translation of silence. And I would go back to my medical training and say that all life begins, in a sense, through the process we name translation of the RNA molecule into protein. You know, there's the transcription process, and then there's the translation process. And the translation process is actually when you take the nucleic acids and translate them into proteins. And proteins are what makes a cell tick. And once you make a cell tick, life ticks.
And there's still something mysterious about that, isn't there? I mean, is there still, even though we can pinpoint the proteins and the cellular structures, surely still there's some little kernel of mystery of kind of, how does that happen?
Yes, and, you know, we're working hard to make sure we leave nothing unknown.
So. Well, that's a shame in some ways.
Well, I think the more we know, that will always be something we don't know. So what it is what we may not be able to imagine just yet.
Yeah. That makes me wonder whether you see, or what similarities you see between practicing medicine as a physician and poetry and translation.
Yes, that's a good and tough question. I think the greatest parallel between poetry and medicine is actually about how does one manage uncertainty? Because whenever one of us is ill with something that may be the auger of chronic illness or is a chronic illness, it's a conversation with uncertainty and with what life means and with what the unknown is about. And that's, I think, the most difficult thing to do in medicine, because science does not claim a conversation with the unknown, but the human mind and body is not only obsessed, but entrapped into this conversation of the unknown. And that throws us back to the spiritual and the religious and the mythic and so forth in human history. So it's a really delicate balance to try to navigate these things as one deals with, you know, other fellow human beings who are in immediate need and almost an act of despair at times. And of course, you know, as a physician, I know sooner or later my time's going to come. You know, it's my turn to be a patient. And some of us are already there.
It's interesting. I was thinking, you know, when I have to go to the doctor, it is an act of translation in the sense that my body is saying things that I can't even interpret. And the physician, I'm hoping, is going to be the translator.
But I'd like to go back and also say, you know, I did some time with Doctors Without Borders a few years back, and I realized that illness is one of the first displacements that we learn. When you suddenly are not yourself, when you're a young kid and you have a fever and your mother is sitting at the edge of your bed caring for you, and you just feel that what happened, that it just sort of alienated me from my understanding of time, of perception, of my relationship with my body.
Sure, you enter into this other world.
Right. And then as we grow older, that other world becomes more present than those episodes in childhood. But somehow I think we don't do enough to reconcile that feeling of displacement, being one's own refugee, if you will, with a greater empathy and understanding of the larger world.
If I'm reading you right, what you're saying is we all are exiles. I know you've written as, for you, it's not metaphoric, it's a family lineage.
Absolutely. I think it's an essential characteristic of the human condition. We try to displace it further, ironically, by putting it within geopolitical boundaries as an understanding of what exile or displacement or refugeehood is and so forth, as if the only understanding of that way of being is through those artificial man-made constructs of the nation state. You know, to go back and echo great writers and thinkers, if race, and I think it is a construct, well, if you believe in that, then you should also have an easier time believing that also the nation state is also a construct, because it is.
But can you extrapolate from that then, turn the analogy back to, for instance, the way Palestinians are constructed today, or Palestinian identity is constructed and seen today in the West?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer in a sort of a pretty sentence or two. I think the biggest difficulty Palestinians face in the West has to do with the hierarchy of suffering or a classification of suffering.
What do you mean?
What do I mean about the classification of suffering is, for example, the trouble, the ethical trouble of triage. So to bring it back to medicine, if someone comes in with a heart attack and someone comes in with severe pain from a broken wrist, I'd have to figure out that, well, the person with a heart attack is probably going to die pretty quickly. The person with severe pain is not, so I'm going to have to think about the wrist a little later or just give a shot of morphine to alleviate the pain while I attend to the person with a heart attack. In larger collective human suffering, we've convinced ourselves that we're able to do triage, which is to say, an entire people who have been displaced, lost so much of their sense of self and being and belonging, matters less because of a different kind of suffering. For the Palestinian in the West, it's always having to answer to the hierarchy of anti-Semitism as a greater suffering. And I think that's an ethical problem. On a personal level, I would say that when I was with Doctors Without Borders and I was in the refugee camps in Zambia and in Sudan and Darfur, one of the powerful feelings that would never leave me was that there are these moments where I cannot come up to someone there and say, hey, Mr. Daniel, who's an Angolan refugee in Zambia, I don't think your suffering is as bad as those in Darfur, because they're being ethnically cleansed or whatever political names we attribute to collective suffering. Because when you see it there, you realize that the human mind is actually incapable of distinguishing these things. But it's politics that prevent us from, and when I say politics, I mean means to power.
So what you're describing is a situation in which you're working inside power structures. Where does that leave you? How do you negotiate that or manage the difficulty of working inside a system and at the same time not wanting to be complicit?
If I knew the answer, I'd either be a fool or a liar. It's something I struggle with every day, I think, maybe more than I should. And not to be really cheesy in saying this, but the hope remains in having these conversations with people like you. It's a degree of uncertainty because I didn't know that, you know, you exist, but I always believed that you do, in a sense. So just one goes on about their day and attending to small and large things and believe in the good collective of the human race.
Fatty, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fatty Judah is a poet, physician, and translator. His most recent collection of poems is called A Light. He's also published several award-winning translations of Palestinian poets, Mahmoud Darwish and Ghassan Zaktan. If you want to read his new poem, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. Our partner on the News from Poems series is the new poetry website, asphodel.info. And our featured poet next week is Nick Lance. He's got a brand new book of poems just out called You Beast. So check that out ahead of time if you want. Bottom line, read more poetry and support contemporary poets. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.